afternoon, everybody. We're here today. Today's speaker is Professor Scott Carney, or Paul Carney, if you're actually in the hotel. Which is kind of confusing to call him. That's the P sound. He is a professor at the University of Illinois, the Urbana-Champaign, which is one of the absolutely top-notch departments of electrical engineering in the United States. He was an undergraduate there a few years ago, after which he went to the University of Rochester to do a PhD with my old sidekick, Emma Wolfe, the author of Born and Wolfe, the light classics. After which he went to Washington University in St. Louis to do a postdoc with John Schottland in medical imaging. And from there he went on to Illinois to be a professor, and he's going up the protocol there, doing all sorts of neat things about seeing things which are smaller than you should be able to see them. Things which are too small to really see, you can see them. That's what today's talk is about. And it's got something which is, well, you'll see, it's got something which has got lots of applications in just about everything, because if you think about it, physics, most of the physics is about seeing things. So, without more ado, Scott.
Great. Thank you, Daniel. it's a great pleasure to be here. First of all, because it's Toronto, and I love Toronto, and it's just wonderful to be up in Canada, our great sister to the north. And it's great to see Daniel. Daniel's an old friend, and I really appreciate the invitation and the opportunity to meet all of you. I've already had a chance to talk with some of you this morning, and it's been a real pleasure. So as Daniel said, I'm in a department of electrical engineering. I was told that the colloquium would be heavily attended by undergraduates, and that obviously it's a physics colloquium. So not that I would really hold myself up as much of a model for anything, but I think I am a pretty good model for perhaps how to make your way through the world on limited talents and ambition. I was actually a physics student as an undergraduate at UIUC. I did my undergraduate degree in physics, got my PhD in physics, and sort of migrated into engineering. And I think this is sort of a natural life cycle for someone like me. Engineering in an academic environment is very much about doing near past physics and applying it to problems that we don't yet know how to solve. And so today I'm going to talk to you about one of the main branches in my research, which is computed imaging. Daniel mentioned a big part of that is in near-field optics, seeing things that are really sort of too small to see. And I'm also going to talk to you about another microscopy problem, which has a little more impact immediately in medical imaging. And I sort of prepared an introduction, which is perhaps a bit more historical, and I hope will be useful to the undergraduates in the audience, or actually to everybody. Here we go. Let's see, that's the wrong direction. Let's try that one. Okay, so first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the members of my group that contributed to the work I'm going to show you today. Bryn Davis is a brilliant postdoc. Ooh, hey, Daniel, would you actually have an extra laser pointer? This one's a bit weak. Bryn Davis is a brilliant postdoc in my group, brilliant postdocs are a wonderful thing to have. Jin Sun, a brilliant, well, I guess maybe this is visible, is a brilliant grad student who just finished his PhD this spring. Bryn works on everything, and Jin works in, primarily on the near-field problem. Despite Bryn being from New Zealand and Jin being from China, the fact that they are both brilliant and have similar sounding names, Bryn and Jin, I would regularly confuse them and call one the other, so it's sort of the running joke in my group. I'm a theorist, so I just sort of do long division for a living, and I have to work with experimenters, and so no talk is complete without acknowledgments to my experimental collaborators. I'm going to talk about OCT and something called ISAM, and that's done in collaboration with Stephen Bopart's group at Illinois. A graduate student recently finished, Tyler Ralston, contributed heavily, Adam Zisk to a smaller extent, and a brilliant postdoc in Steve's group named Dan Marks, who really made the whole thing work. And then in the near-field optical tomography stuff that I'm going to show you today, my postdoctoral mentor and collaborator, John Schottland, and my postdoctoral crushmate and collaborator, Vadim Markel, contributed heavily to the work. Then another former postdoc of mine who's currently at Michigan, and Sergei Bolzhevoni, who was at Aalborg, did an experiment with me, and that's where we got the experimental data. Okay, so I'd like to sort of talk about inverse problems in general. And for me, this is really where engineering and physics come together in a beautiful marriage. So there are lots of examples, and these are just a few, of engineers going out, and sometimes physicists, but oftentimes engineers going out, and, well, sometimes chemists too, for that matter, going out and building really neat bits of instrumentation. I need an instrument that just acquires a signal somehow. And at first blush, that signal seems to be a direct measurement of some quantity. And so, you might build yourself a radar. It's got a bunch of tubes in it, and it brings in a certain frequency and tells you, well, if I send out a pulse at this frequency, I get an echo and at some time later, and you can make little radar echograms. Or if you're a chemist, you might go out and say, well, you know, I can differentiate certain species by looking at magnetic resonance signals, nuclear or electron spin magnetic resonance signals. And so NMR gets sort of invented as a form of spectroscopy, a way to acquire a chemical signature. Or, you know, you're Röntgen and you happen to figure out how to get silver plates to record X-ray shadowgrams, and this is one of those things that, at first glance, looks like it produces pictures of internal structure of the body, and I'm going to try to convince you today that it does not produce pictures of internal structure of the body, but in all three of these examples, it's brilliant instrumentation with immediate leaps forward. That are reasons in themselves to get very excited about being able to take these measurements, but with a little more thought by, hopefully, usually, physicists, you can connect the thing that you're measuring, the signal, to the thing that you actually wanted to know about, the internal structure of the object. And so that's the general theme of the talk today. This last panel down here is something I've been working on recently called optical coherence tomography, and it really suffers from its own success in that the raw data in certain regimes look an awful lot like the object that you were looking to image. And so for about 15 years, people sort of stopped at that point and said, great, we're done, let's have a party. And no one really thought more about it, and we've done a little more thinking about that recently. And perhaps not at the grandiose scale that these things got extended, but this got extended as well. So what did they get extended into? Working with two hands and two pointers now, it's liable to get confusing. Okay, so NMR, of course, turns into MRI with a little bit of thought. You connect the physics and the signal, you use physics to connect the signal and the thing that you're actually looking at, and you do a bit of math in a computer, and you take that spectroscopy, the little spikes in the signal you were looking at before, and turn them into images. Radar gets turned into something called synthetic aperture radar. This is an important technology to keep your eye on for today's talk, because one of the things I'm going to talk to you today about today is sort of synthetic aperture radar moved down six orders of magnitude in size scales. But again, it's a question of connecting the recorded electrical signal to the thing that you are really interrogating through physics. And lastly, of course, X-rays, as most of you probably know, get turned into computed tomograms, which are really pictures of internal structure. Okay, and OCT gets turned into something else, and you'll have to wait a minute to see how that works. So here's the idea, that an X-ray is not really an image, it's a shadowgram. It's a projection. It's a whole bunch of stuff slapped together, a linear superposition of a whole bunch of things that you would really like to know individually. And the physics that connects the shadowgram to the structure of the object is just Beer's law. You get to Beer's law by starting, possibly, you might just guess Beer's law, actually, which is really how it starts originally, but you start with Maxwell's equations, you do a bit of asymptotics, you get out geometrical optics, you make a few assumptions on top of the geometrical optics, and out pops Beer's law. And Beer's law tells you that if you shine an X-ray source on one side of your patient, That's the intensity going in, IFP. And you look at the intensity on the other side of the patient. IFP naught goes in, IFP comes out, and it's just scaled by this exponential. And in the exponent, we have a line integral along the ray path of the absorption index alpha. So this turns out to be a tractable mathematical problem that if we record the intensity at enough pairs of points, P and P naught on either side of the patient, we can solve what's called the inverse problem and extract this little function alpha from measurements of I at P and P naught. And so you begin with a bit of instrumentation. You add a little bit of physics. You do a little bit of math. And you stir. And out comes that. Okay? And so that's the basic message here. And this is, in my view, this is really where physicists can make a living. Okay? So what about NMR? So we connect spectra over here in some sense. It's a little simpler than this, actually, because you don't want all the spectra. You really just want proton density. But nonetheless, you connect things that were an instrument that was designed to measure spectra and designed to tell you what species you have in your jar. And you do a bit of physics, and you say, okay, well, the frequencies I'm measuring over here are really just given by twice the magnetic field times the magnetic moment divided by h-bar. And if I can then encode the magnetic field B with spatial structure, I can make maps of the thing I'm trying to image. So again, I'm connecting structure to signals with physics. The math is actually very similar to the bit of math you do for the X-ray problem. Eventually, everything sort of reduces down to something called the Fourier slice theorem. And it's a linear inverse problem. And you make fast algorithms on a computer, and you take a bunch of signals and turn them into images. And of course, the physics really comes out of, again, Maxwell's equations. That's a common theme. You do some quantum mechanics with the spin in, and out you get the expressions for the Larmor frequency. And really, you want to add a little stat max so that you can get the two different time constants, tau 1 and tau 2 time constants. But this is where, again, physicists make their living, and engineers can make images out of the resulting instrumentation plus physics. Radar. Radar is an echogram. And there are lots of things in instrumentation that show up as echograms. So whether it's your sonogram, you go to the doctor and get a sonogram of your abdomen, see what's in there, see if there might be a kid in there, or maybe it's just kidneys or something, but you get a sonogram, that's an echogram. Radar returns are echograms of a very similar type. Waves are waves, it's different wavelengths and different scales, but echograms. Or for that matter, you set off a small explosive over here on the ground, and you listen over here on the ground, and you try to reconstruct the velocity profile in the ground from echograms. And here, the physics is, again, Maxwell's equations plus an assumption about the object. And this is really where this comes in. We assume that the scene is just a reflecting scene, and we really just want to reconstruct the reflectance. And then the signal that we measure over here is just related to some spectral weighting times this kernel. And what comes out after you do the physics is something called a Stolt mapping. And again, we rely on people who can build instruments and then people who can solve the inverse problem to undo the Stolt mapping to make that into that. And it's generally the case that lay people find this to be a much more useful thing than this. And for that matter, trained technicians. Okay, so that's sort of the historical introduction about inverse problems and the spiel about inverse problems and the role of physics in turning external measurements into reconstructions of internal structure. So I'd like to talk to you today about a couple of problems that I've worked on recently, which I think are relatively good examples of that same historical process applied to perhaps not quite so important or grandiose problems, but to problems that are fairly modern. This is something that I've been working on recently. Optical coherence tomography is a funny kind of imaging technique because it's got tomography right in the word, and it's a little misleading. It is tomographic in the sense that Tomography is just from the Greek. It means to render something in slices. And OCT, to some extent, does let you render things in slices. But it's not a tomogram in the sense of a computed tomogram from X-rays. So there's really no computation going on. It's much more akin, what I'm going to show you here for the raw instrument, is much more akin to the original X-rays. It looks like something. Okay, I'm going to show you pictures that look like things. And it's very satisfying to sort of take that data and say, it looks like something, and we're done, and so we've made tomographs. And I'm going to try and convince you that it's a little more than that. So this is how it works. It is sort of like range finding. So I ask you, how far away is the wall? And you shine a laser at the wall, and you have an interferometer on the back end, and you measure how much phase has been accumulated on the round trip to the wall and back, and you can tell me how far away the wall is. So that's fine. You can do time of flight that way. You can do that acoustically. I can send out an acoustic pulse and measure the time between the emanation of the pulse and the return signal and do the same sort of thing and tell you how far away a wall is. In OCT, we do this by sending a laser beam into a sample that we wish to image. But before we send it, our laser into the sample on its own, we pull off a little reference field, and we throw it into what amounts to a Michelson interferometer, and we run this thing, we run a variable delay on the reference arm back into a detector to mix with the beam coming back from the sample. And rather than try to time the delay from signal out to back, we rely on something called coherence gating. So this source is assumed to be a statistically stationary broadband source. And so the light that comes out of it has a finite coherence length. And beyond a certain delay, that is beyond a delay corresponding to a length longer than the coherence length, the reference field will not interfere with the sample field. And so we can match path lengths from the mirror to the sample and the mirror to the reference mirror by moving the reference mirror back and forth and looking for fringes to appear in our signal. And so that's exactly what's done. And so you do that once and you get a distance to sample. But the sample's semi-transparent, and so it's actually made up of a whole series of little weak reflectors. And so we get back a whole bunch of little spikes in the envelope over the interferogram. And when we plot the envelope of the interferogram, we get something that corresponds to the depth structure of the object, and then we move the beam over the sample and pile them next to each other to make an image. Okay. So this is sort of what it looks like. I do my coherence-gated echo location over here with the beam in a fixed position going into the sample. And you can see that, oh, look, there's something, there's a strong reflector up front, and there are weaker reflectors behind it. And here's just an illustration of my beam going into the object. And I just move that beam along the object. And at every scan along here, I take my signal over here and put it on a grayscale and plot it. And I obtain an image this way. And it works reasonably well. And so this is OCT. This is how it works. And there are a few things that I'd like to point out about this. That first of all, notice that the thing that gets plotted over here is really just the envelope of this interferogram. And that this picture kind of makes sense as long as you believe that I'm sampling my object along the line represented by this arrow. Then that I can just pile these things next to each other independently to obtain an image. And that's what makes the whole thing go. The problem is that I don't want to get to the problem yet. So these are the sorts of things you use OCT for. It's used in examination of the eye. It's a clinical instrument now for examination of the retina. In the States anyway, it's approved. Eye doctors use it all the time to look at the back of the eye. People are starting to use it to examine the eardrum, things like this. It's also used. And this is where I come in because we're very interested in using OCT as a replacement for histology. In other words, you go in, you get a piece of tissue cut out of you, and they send it off to a histologist who stains it and looks at the microscope. We'd really like to be able to replace histology, or at least augment histology, with OCT images of the tissue, in part because OCT doesn't require you to do what histology does. In histology, you take a piece of tissue, you slice it really thinly. You put a chemical on it that changes the chemical composition of the object, and then you put it in a microscope and you kind of squeeze it between a couple slides and hope that the morphology that you started with is now represented in this thing you've sliced, diced, and dyed. In OCT, we sort of take a piece of tissue out, put it in the microscope, and shine light into it that doesn't really do much to it. And so we like this idea that we can kind of come in and not destroy the tissue and give you a good picture that might be diagnostic. And so this is just sort of our motivation. Okay, so here's the problem with OCT. This is a picture of titanium dioxide particles embedded in silicone. Does anyone know the common name for this substance? Anyone? Paint. Yes, this is paint. This is essentially common house paint. And if you pack them densely enough, you can get an opalescent transition, sure. Absolutely. But the picture you see here is essentially of house paint. And I've gone begging to Glidden and Dutch Boy, and they won't come up with funding. But nonetheless, it should be a fairly statistically homogeneous object. That is, these little dots down here represent titanium dioxide particles that are a bit smaller than the resolution limit of our instrument. And so they come through as points. And the stuff up here just doesn't look right. And you can see that it doesn't look right. This region should look statistically the same as the region down here. Okay. So here is the heart of the problem. So OCT, I mentioned, is really based on an assumption I said before that you could trust the idea that the echograms you get come from that line drawn down into your object. Okay, so this requires two conflicting beliefs, that you can create a beam of light that is both well localized and well collimated. Okay, and so I'm talking to physicists, and you all go, delta P, delta X, H bar on 2, you can, right? Okay, right? This all makes sense. So you know that's just silly. And so, but it is, from an engineering perspective, it's a very good approximation to a low NA focused beam. And this region over which this approximation holds up is the essentially the Rayleigh range, or twice the Rayleigh range. And as long as that coherence length of the light we're using is much shorter than this distance, the whole thing works pretty well. Okay, so we go in, we've got a column over which we can image. These little packets represent the regions that we can slice with coherence gating, and that's the basis of OCT. Unfortunately, if you want to do things at very high resolution, you want to say, we work in OCT typically around the 1 micron regime, 800 nanometers, that sort of wavelength of light. If you want to push your resolution down into the sort of 1 micron size scale, then you have to use a high NA optical system to focus your light down in. A high NA system means that the focused beam looks a bit more like this. There's a lot of divergence in the beam. The equiphase fronts bend a lot out here, and this region over which you can assume the beam is sort of well collimated and well localized begins to get comparable to the coherence length that we're gating with. And so that really is a problem. Now, early in the history of OCT, people overcame this problem by saying, okay, I'm just going to ignore these regions out here, and I'm going to get as many slices as I can in this region with my coherence length, which might only be 1 or 2 or 3 slices. And then I'm going to refocus the beam deeper into the sample. And so now you get something that looks very much like confocal microscopy. In confocal microscopy, you scan the beam this way, and you scan the focus up and down through the sample, and you acquire an image by scanning in 3 dimensions physically. Okay. And then as you really approach the confocal limit, the coherence gate still has advantages. It produces better signal to noise, et cetera, but you no longer really have a tomographic technique. Okay. So then a few years ago, along came a new technique called spectral domain OCT. And in spectral domain OCT, rather than have an interferometer on the back end where you match path lengths with a reference arm, eventually the OCT community heard about the Fourier transform. You can only keep things secret from engineers for so long. And they, instead of measuring the autocorrelation, they measure the power spectrum instead, right? Okay, so you replace the interferometer. You still need a reference, but it can be at fixed position, a fixed delay reference. And then you have a grating spectrometer here and a line camera, and you measure spectra, you take a Fourier transform, and voila, you have an image. And this little animation here is just meant to illustrate that here is a signal from my reference, here is a delayed signal from in the sample, and you can see this is the spectrum down here, and sorry, the labels didn't show up on this background, but this is the spectrum, and as these things are close together, you can see these oscillations encode that distance between the reference and the reflection, okay? And so Fourier transforms give you back all that position data. Oh, I guess I don't need to do that. Okay. Let me say one more thing about this. So now we're in the position that, whereas in the so-called time domain regime, we could just acquire the data corresponding to regions in this focal region. Now with spectral domain, there are these advantages. You've eliminated a moving part in your instrument. That's always good. In engineering, it's always good to cut down on the number of moving parts. That's great. But we've also now created a situation where, whether we like it or not, we are collecting all of the data at once. So all depths contribute to this interferogram, all depths into the sample at once, and we can't just scan that little piece of the sample where we have a good focus. We have to actively work to throw away data. And that is really a cardinal sin, right? Never throw away perfectly good data. Okay? I used to sort of make fun of the OCT guys and telling them that one of my OCT friends came home from the record store with a CD. He was really excited and couldn't wait to get it home. And he was going to play it as soon as he managed to buff out all these terrible little pits on the backside. Right? So that's really what was going on. Here's the strategy. We're going to follow the historical example. Develop a forward model. That's the physics, right? We're going to do physics. Then we're going to do some math to linearize if we can, because linear inverse problems are a lot easier to solve than nonlinear inverse problems. Then we're going to simulate the forward data and see if it looks sensible. If it doesn't look sensible, we're done there. We need to start back at step one. And hopefully write down a solution to the so-called inverse problem. Okay, so I'm going to buzz through the math a bit quickly here. I just want people to kind of see what it looks like. On the one hand, it looks like a lot of math, but on the other hand, it's not that much math. So I kind of want to give the impression that it's not very difficult, because it's not very difficult. So you have an incident field that you shine into your sample. The sample has some inhomogeneity in it that interacts with the sample structure. The sample structure is going to be denoted by this function eta, and it gets propagated away with the Green's function g. You add up all of those events, and you get back the scattered field that comes back towards your scanning system. Your scanning system then couples the field back in again, and so you wind up taking that US and hitting it against the thing that came out, because the same thing that goes in is basically the thing that came out. It's like match filtering. And then you get a signal that looks like this. So I have a signal which is a function of the transverse position and the wave number k, and I have an object which is a function of three spatial positions here in the sample. And out of all of these, out of this five-folded integral, and from measurements of this thing, I want to extract eta, this function here. And that's the thing I really wanted from the get-go. Okay? And here's a bit of math. Here's where, you know, we just sort of guess. We guess at things. We assume the beam's Gaussian. The wonderful thing about Gaussians is that the Fourier transform of a Gaussian is Gaussian. Yeah, I looked it up twice. It works. And then you've got a Green's function, and this is a free space Green's function, which has this nice plane wave representation, which we'll use in a second. We've actually implemented this with more sort of fiddly detailed Green's functions for the particular geometries in which we work. And this little thing down here is very important. This is the dispersion relation. And it just says that I can pick any two components of a wave vector for a plane wave going into the system. So two components represented by Q, fix the third component to be consistent with the wave equation. And it says that you have a wave number K, and the third component has to be the square root of K squared minus Q squared, so that the whole thing has the right length. The momentum vector has the right length. Okay, and so we put all that together in a forward model, and you know, the papers are there if you really want to torture yourself with the math. But the important thing, I think, is that that's what we predict happens. And actually, I could have picked a better example from actual data, but it sort of looks like data. The data are up here. You see that you've got this sort of blurring, and you see the same sort of blurring here. One of the things I'd like to emphasize is that, by the way, it's not really blurring. It's defocus. So blurring is what happens when you sort of take a real Gaussian and convolve it with an image. That blurs things. These are really, if you'll see, stripy. And the stripy bits mean that you're getting coherent superposition of signals that interfere with each other. Okay? And so these are the pits on the back of the CD, right? This is where the real information is. That's good stuff. You shouldn't throw it away. So we don't. We instead solve this inverse problem. And remind you, we're going to measure S. We're going to find eta. So we take a Fourier transform, and we go from a five-folded integral to a three-folded integral. That's progress. Then we do some asymptotic expansions. And if there's time afterwards and anyone would like to discuss with me the merits of being good over or being lucky over good, I'm happy to do that, because it turns out that there are two different asymptotic regimes here, and they both yield expressions that are nearly identical. And the first time I worked out the problem, I'd picked the wrong one. But it turned out that they yielded things that were interchangeable. So I got lucky, and I wasn't very good. But here it is. So the important thing to take note of here is that you take your data, and you take a 2D Fourier transform. That's what this thing says. And it turns out to be related to a 3D Fourier transform of the thing you're looking for. They have the same transverse wave vector, Q, but their third component of the wave vector here is a function of the wave number and the transverse Fourier component here. This relationship is the same no matter which asymptotic expansion you take. It turns out the prefactors change, but the prefactors don't really matter that much when you're doing the reconstructions, and so that's how we got lucky. In any event, this is great news, because we went from five integrals to three to zero, and zero is very good. So, okay. So here's what you do. You've got a signal that looks like this. It's something times the thing you're looking for, and you write this down as a so-called regularized or Tikhonov regularized solution to take care of noise and things like that. But nonetheless, the important thing to note is that there's something out here that multiplies the data function and moves the data from coordinates Q and K to coordinates Q and beta. This sort of an algorithm is called a resampling algorithm, and it just so happens that resampling algorithms are the basis of the inversion of the Radon transform, and therefore the basis of the algorithms that underlie synthetic aperture radar, magnetic resonance imaging, and computed tomography. They can be implemented fast. They're algebraic, fast algorithms, and the difference between these guys and the thing that we're doing in our little experiment is that whereas this requires the Fourier slice theorem is a resampling from a polar grid to a Cartesian grid, we're just resampling from a hyperbolic grid to a Cartesian grid. But algebraically, it all looks the same, which is great news for us. Okay. Okay, so here's what happens when the rubber meets the road. This is, again, paint. And we have purposefully put the focus of the OCT instrument right up here at the front of this panel. And as you go back, this back panel is about 9 Rayleigh ranges, so 9 of those focal lengths away from the front panel. And you can see these little boxes are shown up here. 3 is the nearest one. You can kind of tell these are point-like objects. 2, if you look at a big enough field, you might believe there are a bunch of point-like objects. And 1, you can see there's just this stripy, blurry kind of mess in the background. You do the bit of the physics and the bit of mathematical jiggery-pokery I had up there a second ago, and that's what happens. Ta-da! And that's it. So That's as good as it gets. That's all I've got, really. And I sometimes I just sort of flip back and forth between them. I sit at my desk and do this. I'm like, oh, wow. Because as a theorist, you have to understand that when something, you know, I collaborate with an experimenter and it kind of works, I sit there for weeks just going, it worked. So so here, you know, again, pretty pictures. We've got great grad students who can render things in ways that are really attractive. So that goes to that. Again, no one cares about paint. People care about this stuff. So this is breast tissue, and there is a tumor here, and there's a necrotic boundary up here, and this is the histology. And it's again because histology requires slicing and dicing and staining and horrible things to do to tissue. You can't get the morphology to match one to one, but you can take these images and say that you can believe that the reconstruction is at least diagnostically useful, whereas the unprocessed data up here are really not. Now, I'd like to emphasize, you could obtain this reconstruction directly using OCT by moving the focus, okay? So right now, we're working on putting together a little company to build these kinds of microscopes. And when you start worrying about real-world applications and putting things in an operating room and not requiring someone with a PhD in engineering to sit in the operating room to keep the instrument running, not having to have the mechanical complexity of a refocusing element in your system makes an enormous difference. And so that's part of what we're excited about here. As a scientist, I'm excited because these things are actually now, the reconstructions as opposed to the raw data are quantitatively meaningful. We really reconstruct ADA. And that may, in the end, be useful as well. So, all right. So that's it for the OCT thing. I'd like to buzz through something completely different. Daniel sort of promised I would talk about near field, so I'm going to. Near field's a little bit older work in my own timeline. It's also a scanning modality. So again, you're going to we take a probe and scan it over the sample, but now the probe is just essentially a sharpened fiber. It's put very close to the sample. The experiment I'm going to show you is also interferometric, although it's a direct single frequency hologram rather than a broadband hologram, and the problem is sort of a bit harder mathematically. Okay. But I think there's actually a lovely example of why physics matters in this. So here's something from the early 90s. Ken and I were just talking about the great promise of near field in the 90s, and then it kind of went meh. So here's one of the problems we'd like to solve in the near field. So you can see that these are images that were obtained by Betzig and Troutman back in 92. And they took a near-field probe and just an ENSOM probe and scanned over this little image of AT&T ENSOM. And every scan plane, so they're scanning like this. You know, my AT&T ENSOM is written on the table, and they're going just over the top of it with a laser or with a probe that they're shining a laser on and scanning. And at every panel, as you go up through the letters, they pull their probe back a little bit. Okay, so now at the time, this was billed as a lovely demonstration of the fact that as you move away from the near field in near field optics, the image blurs, and that this is due somehow to the loss of evanescent waves, because the evanescent waves decay exponentially, and they carry all the high spatial frequency information, et cetera, et cetera. But in the OCT problem I just showed you, there were no evanescent waves, but as you move away from the focal plane, things blur out and get harder to interpret and not as useful. So there's really a second effect here, and it turns out the second effect is at least as important, which is that there's defocusing going on. You can't just stick a chunk of metal over your sample and move it back and forth and think that the signal you return is going to mean something. You have to do the physics. You have to do the physics that connects your signal to the sample structure. Okay, so that's what we tried to do. So here's a particular modality that we did an experiment in. And it's a photon scanning tunneling microscope. And most of the world calls these things images. And I would like to call them holograms. These are really, in the original sense of Dennis Gabor's proposal for holography, these are Gabor-type holograms, in that you take a laser, you shine it, ignore this branch for a moment because we block one branch of this at a time. So you shine it up to your sample. Now here I'm going through a prism and I'm illuminating my sample S with an evanescent wave through the prism face. And then over the top of the sample, I scan a sharp probe near the object, it's near field, and I record some transmission into that fiber. In the Gabor-type hologram, you illuminate an object. So that object is semi-transparent, let's say. Some of the field is scattered by the object, and some of it passes directly through and goes to the film. The unaltered field interferes with the scattered field and creates a Gabor hologram. Exactly the same thing happens here. Some of this evanescent field that illuminates the sample gets picked up by the fiber up here, and some of it's scattered by the sample and also gets picked up by the fiber. And the two fields get superposed, and they get sucked up into the detector, and you measure the square amplitude. Great. And let me show you now why these are not images, because this thing and this thing are the same field of view. Okay? This hologram and this hologram are the same field of view. The difference is that this hologram was recorded with the light coming in from the right side, and this hologram was recorded with the light coming in from the left side. They're holograms. It's that simple. You record a hologram with two different reference fields. The thing you record looks different. Okay. So we went ahead and did some mathematical jiggery-pokery. It's very much the same thing I just showed you, except that we include all of those evanescent waves, and we don't go make far-field beam-like approximations and things like that. Don't worry about any of that. It's it's a dispersion relation again, right? That's an important thing. There's a scattered field, and we take Fourier transforms, and there are Green's functions in there, and we want to reconstruct this thing V from measurements of U, et cetera. Okay, and we do this, this calculation of the so-called pseudo-inverse for the linearized problem. Again, for those of you that care, we could talk about this stuff, but it's not that important except to say that we figured out how to get this thing from this thing, how to get the structure from measurements of the field. Okay, so then we go and apply it. We take these two holograms and we do the mathematical jiggery-pokery, and the results are terrible, really bad, really just awful, because this doesn't really, I'm going to show you the actual object in a minute, because we have atomic force microscope images of the actual topography of the object for cross-validation, and it doesn't look like this. So what's wrong here? So the problem is that we needed to fix the physics. And so again, I'd like to just say to all the young physicists in the audience, you can't just sort of pretend the universe is a black box, and like a lot of my friends in engineering like to do, and say, well, we don't need the physicists. We're just going to take a whole bunch of data, and then we're going to massage it until it looks right. So if you attempted that with this problem, you'd be there a long time. So it turned out that the real problem here was that you can formulate the interaction of the light and the scattering tip and the sample as a sort of double parameter, two-parameter perturbation series. And all I want to get you to see in this equation is that there's an incident field that comes in. Okay, and so in this picture, it's this arrow here. The incident field comes in. And it scatters, let us say, from the sample down here. That would be this term. So UI hits S. S is an operator that takes the incident field, turns it into scattered field. So where does the scattered field go? Well, if we're going to measure it, it's got to get back out to us, and it does that by interacting with the tip. So S goes to T, and then we measure that. Okay. The other option was actually that the light could come in, hit the tip, then hit the sample, and if you do something called illumination mode ensemble, it's T goes to S, and you measure it. Or you could have light that comes in, and it scatters off the tip, and then off the sample, and then back into the tip, and you measure that. Or it hits the sample, and then it hits the tip, and then it hits the tip again. That's kind of like a self-energy kind of term. Or it hits the tip and the tip and the sample, or the sample and the tip and the sample, etc. So if you look at this whole thing and you assume that your sample is sort of the weak scatterer in the problem, you can throw away all the higher order terms in S, and you just keep everything else, you can resum all of these things. And this is where the cool bits of physics comes in, because when I was a boy in physics school, they taught us how to resum things, and so we went ahead and did that. And when you resum all the terms that are linear in S but nonlinear in T, you can actually regroup them and calculate a new effective T parameter, and that T parameter lets you write the entire series, linear in S, as things that only look like either this term, or this term, and all of those are linear in S, and we can solve the inverse problem. And it's a big mathematical mess, but it was very doable. And the physics this time worked. So here's the AFM. This is the thing it should look like. And here is the reconstruction from the holograms. Now, there's a central island. There's a little thing up here. There's a bit of schmutz down here. There are no stripey bits. And the thing that you can't see is that over here on the color bar, unfortunately, we were before reconstructing negative values of the susceptibility in these black regions down here. Those went away. Everything is positive the way it ought to be. The morphology is basically right. And no stripey, silly bits of stuff. And it all came down to just getting the physics right. The rest of it was just a bit of math and programming. But the physics had to be right. And it, when it was, it all worked. OK. So I'd like to conclude. My conclusions are that inverse scattering computed imaging extend the utility and scope of data collection methods. That is, whenever I see an instrument that just collects a signal that seems really useful, I like to ask, right, but what are you really measuring? And as physicists, most of us are comfortable with that idea. You always want to ask, no, it's not just a signal, it's a transformation of something. It's connected to some underlying process. What is that process? In all of these computed imaging modalities, the big ones, the really important ones, CT and MRI and the like, and SAR and Fourier migration, seismography, and the like, physics makes it go. The rest of it's just poking around until it works, but the physics really makes it go. ISAM is easy and much better than OCT, and near-field optical tomography is hard, but at least it means something. And we actually have the math all worked out to do the full 3D problem for near-field, but it turns out to be really hard to actually build the instrument. And that's it. That's the end of my sort of standard menu. And if anyone would like to talk about sort of the dessert options later, there are another 30 slides if you have any questions. So thank you very much. I promise you, this gentleman has not been paid off. So another way of asking about the resolution might be to ask about the point spread function. Is that okay? So here's something. We have theoretical curves that pretty much lie on top of these ones, these curves modulo the jitter up in here. And so this is the width of the point spread function for the paint problem, but obtained experimentally. And the way we do that is we take the full 3D image, and then we take the magnitude of that and take its Fourier transform, measure the bandwidth, and then take 1 over the bandwidth. And that gives us the width of the point spread function in a statistical sense over the whole thing as a function of height. We do this in each plane as a function of height. And if you look at OCT, down here in the focus, OCT has a minimum point spread function down here that is for this. Actually, we normalized everything to the spot width, but if I recall correctly, spot width here was around 4 microns. Okay, so this is not as tight as you could go, but not too bad either. The other axis is labeled in Rayleigh ranges. Okay, and so as you go out, one Rayleigh range, it begins to spread a little bit, and this is typically where you cut off OCT, right out here. And then it climbs and climbs and climbs, and the jittery bit up here comes in because when you get out here, and this image is from out here, the coherent overlap of the point spread function actually begins to create artifacts and now look like points again. And so these things just, it really should just shoot off, but it begins to oscillate because of the artifacts. This is ISAM, and it's the resolution is flat over the whole volume and equal at the origin. And for us, that's it, from a medical diagnostic standpoint, that's really important because a lot of histology is based on looking at cell morphology. And you want to ask things like, how big is the nucleus? And if your instrument doesn't have a constant point spread function in space, you don't really know if it's the instrument making the nucleus look bigger than the nuclei down here or if it's really bigger. And so with ISAM here, we can tell you it's the same everywhere. So that's it. Thanks. Yeah.
So in acoustic or elastic imaging, they're dealing mostly with noise and have to tackle the noise problem.
So I kind of blew past it. I agree, the noise problem is important and interesting. We did actually, of course, have to take that into account. Everywhere we do this, we deal with the noise via regularization. You know, I mean, we're not that sophisticated, so we just do Tikhonov regularization. Turns out to be good enough, and it's actually buried right here. N here is the, N is the noise floor. So I kind of blew past it, but that's the idea, is that, of course, for people who don't work on imaging problems, the problem is that when you solve an inverse problem, right, you essentially take your signal S and you hit it with inverse K, which is fine and dandy unless you have some S plus noise, and inverse K, K happens to be really, really small, because then you're dividing by something that's really, really small, and your signal should also be really, really small, but your noise may not be small. And so you sort of do what's called regularization, which is a, you know, a bit of hopeful thinking that makes things smoother. So, yeah. I don't know, was that helpful or nah, maybe? You can press me on it, I don't mind. Yes. Yes.
Is there a sort of analog in the opposite limit of diffusing waves across?
Oh, sure. So the group I came out of in my postdoctoral work, Schottland's group, that was one of their foci was so-called diffuse optical tomography. And there, it's funny though, almost all tractable inverse problems are linear. And so what you do is you say, okay, now I've got something really dense in scatterers. In fact, it's so dense in scatterers that my photons begin to act like little Brownian particles, and they diffuse. And now you swap your wave equation for a diffusion equation. And the thing you try to reconstruct is not the optical susceptibility, but is the spatially varying effective diffusion constant. And you write down a scattering equation for the diffusion equation, which is just another sort of, you know, Born-type series, Liouville-Neumann-type series, and you keep the first term, so you have a linear expression, and you solve a linear inverse problem. Having said that, we've also developed nonlinear inverse series solutions for the near field and for the diffusion problem. How valuable, I have some doubts about how valuable they really are, because the sort of nonlinearity turns on so fast that it becomes a mess before you can even get your hands on it. So, yeah. Thanks.
How far into human tissue can you actually see with those?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it depends on the tissue, very much depends on the tissue. With something like breast tissue, it's typically, you know, 3 millimeters, 5 millimeters on a really good day when the wind is just right, you know. People image through the eye all the time, but, you know, you're not really going through anything, right? The challenge there is you put in some corrective optics to sort of optically remove the eye to get back to the cornea of the retina, I guess. Yeah, the retina's the thing in the back. Sorry, I work with two guys who have MDs, and their usual reaction to me is just sort of shake their heads and walk away. So for typical tissues, not clear tissues like the eye, it's a few millimeters, and the thing that stops you is multiple scattering. I mean, that's what, you hit this wall where the multiple scattering takes off. It's not really absorption. You can still get some signal. It just doesn't mean anything immediately. But by the way, it's a great problem for a physicist because, you know, trying to really connect that data in the intermediate regime between diffusion and weak scattering to deal with that intermediate problem is a real challenge, and we're working on it, but, you know, I'd be happy if someone beat us to it and actually just figured it all out. So.
Questions? I kind of lost a little bit. How could you get rid of the uniqueness of the integral equation?
It turns out that these integral equations have unique solutions, and in fact, the real problem is sort of more related to noise, that you get inconsistencies because you have a completely determined problem and then you add some noise and you have to regularize away the inconsistencies in the equation. And that's what that expression is all about. This is really a pseudo-inverse solution. But if you'll notice, in the signal, and this is a fairly weak argument, but it might be somewhat satisfying at a sort of intuitive level. I have a signal that is a function of either spatial position or, if you like, Fourier coordinate in two dimensions. That's Q. Q lives in two dimensions. K is a wave number. It's a third dimension. It's just frequency, right? It's color. But it's three dimensions of data. So I have a cube of data, if you will. And I have a cube of thing I would like to know. I have an object that lives in three dimensions, and it turns out to be just enough to reconstruct it up to a band pass. Okay, so of course, there's a band limit on how well we can reconstruct, and that sets a resolution limit. And that's it. But it's equal to the original band pass of the system. The original resolution of the OCT system remains the fundamental limiting thing.
No more questions. Let's thank Dr. Manning.